basically what that did is it fast forwarded what I was going to eventually become. And that's where my gratitude comes for the whole process, because in hindsight, I probably could have lived my entire life as an alcoholic. I probably could be a 70-year-old scotch drinking, whiskey drinking, miserable ass of a guy that was just angry and felt screwed all the time.
That was Wilson Horrell, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. Around here, we do risk, resilience, uncertainty, and randomness via long-form conversations with some pretty interesting guests. I am based in London in the United Kingdom. I have listeners from all over the world, and I have guests from all over the world. Wherever you're listening, it's a pleasure to have you with us. And we've had a couple of weeks of hiatus. There was no episode last week. It felt a little bit longer. It's really good to be back. Having said all of that, let's get into the conversation this week, shall we? And to tee it up, I wanted to ask a question. And that is, have you ever caught yourself thinking that it would be wonderful and you would solve the vast majority of your problems if you could win, say, £1 million, £5 million, $2 million, whatever, in the lottery or playing the slot machines in Las Vegas? And I certainly have at various points, particularly when money has been tight. So let's talk about probabilities here, this being a show about randomness. Over here in the UK, the odds of winning the lotto is about 1 in 14 million. In the United States, across the pond, winning the Powerball, which is apparently one of the major lotteries over there, is 1 in 175 million. And we're talking about the major jackpot here, so not just a few £100 or dollars. Similarly, if you went to Las Vegas and played the slot machines and you wanted to win more than $1 million, the odds of doing that are 1 in 49.8 million. Now, what all that means is basically you could play the lottery, you could buy a lottery ticket every week, or you could go and play the slot machines every day, and for several lifetimes, on the basis of probabilities, you would very likely win absolutely nothing. So let's now flip that. And let's think about what would happen if you were one of those one in 49.8 million people that would win at the slot machines in Las Vegas. And by the way, my guest today was one of those people. Wilson Horrell won $2.3 million in the slot machines in Vegas. He was never a big gambler. It was all very casual. And as you'll find out, it was perhaps the best thing that ever happened to him, but not because of what you might think. So what if I asked you, or what if I told you that instead of solving your deepest problems, something like that magnified them 2,000 times, a million times, several times over? Well, that's exactly what happened to Wilson. So let me introduce Wilson. Wilson Horrell is based in Northern Mississippi, which is, of course, in the United States. He's a business owner. He's also a runner, a CrossFitter, a power lifter, and the co-host of a community and a podcast called Lift Heavy, Run Long. And several years ago in 2002, while he was in Las Vegas, he decided to pass the time by playing the slot machines. And in what many would consider to be a dream scenario, he hit the jackpot, $2.3 million. Wow. Right? Now, for several years, Wilson struggled with addiction, and the experience of winning all of this money actually served as an accelerator of both Wilson's downward trajectory, but also his recovery. And that is what he's grateful for. And it makes for a fascinating story and conversation. And in this episode, we get into all of that, plus loads more. So we do talk about that story of him winning the at the slot machines in Vegas, his struggle with addiction and depression. what and how that changes with the money that he won. We get into recovery, gratitude, and then we also get into some of his passions. And endurance sport is one of the themes or one of the threads that runs through the show for the very reason that it's one of my passions. So we talk about that. We talk about CrossFit. We talk about the community and podcast that Wilson co-hosts, Lift Heavy, Run Long. And that's about bringing together people from diverse areas of the fitness world, people who lift and people who run. And if you're involved in either of those communities, you know that there can be a dichotomy and at times a tension. And they have in Lift Heavy, Run Long, an amazing club that is the 50-mile run, 400-pound deadlift club. So people who've done both a 50-mile run, that's an 80-kilometer run, and are able or have done a 400-pound deadlift, that's 181 kilograms. But it is a very diverse community that's not about competition, and we get into all of that, and you'll hear all about that. It's about inclusiveness, and we talk about loads of other great stuff. So without any further delay, I want to give you Wilson Horrell. Enjoy. Wilson, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. This is going to be good fun. I'm sure of it.
Ben, I appreciate you having me on. I'm humbled to be on here, and I appreciate the opportunity to get to know you and visit with you.
Yeah. So I start this off. It works. I tend not to come into these conversations with a set of pre-programmed questions, but there's always one that seems to work to get things going, and that is when people ask you what it is that you do, how do you answer that question?
Well, I own a small weed control and fertilization company, and I do industrial parking lot sweeping, and that's how I make my living. What I do with my life primarily is I stay sober. I'm a drug addict, and I'm a junkie alcoholic, and I'm a guy who's found community in sobriety. And I place a great deal of importance on community. And so what I do is I try to meet as many people as possible. I try to stay as active as possible. And I try to stay out of my own head and in reality as much as I possibly can.
Okay, very cool. We're going to get into all this stuff. And you're calling from Mississippi somewhere?
I'm in North Mississippi, okay. Byhalia, Mississippi, which is 20 minutes outside of Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay. All right, I'm just trying to get my geography set. I love your accent, by the way. We've had a lot of people, different accents. This is the first time we've had a Mississippi accent on the program, so it's really cool. Yeah, I didn't know that it was that far away from Memphis. My geography's excuse my geography or lack of knowledge of geography, but I want to get into your background because you started this landscaping business. I guess I want to start with your story of coming into some money in a very interesting way, in a way that actually a lot of people would dream about. Wondering if you could just go back to that to that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I had what happened to me was everything everybody wants to have happen to them, or at least
they think.
So
they
we
do.
Think.
Yeah,
that's right. In December of 2002, my cousin had made it to the World Championship of the Rodeo as a steer wrestler, and so we went to Las Vegas as a family to celebrate and watch him do what he does. It wasn't a big party tour or anything like that. But I had been hanging around the my mom and my aunt and the other women in my family most of the day, and I came back early to. They were still out shopping, and I said, I'm just going to go back and take a nap. I didn't have very much money, but, I had a few dollars to play anyway, and I stuck a $17 voucher into a quarter slot machine, mm-hmm. and I won this $17 playing Kiss the Frog nickel slots with my mom that morning. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to hang around to get another beer. That's mm-hmm. all I wanted.
Okay.
And I hit the three-quarter progressive jackpot for $2.3 million.
Wow.
And at the time, that was the largest jackpot in Hard Rock Casino history.
Wow. And how's that? How does that work? Like the quarters don't come all split on $2.3 million worth of quarters in the machine. I mean, it must be a big ceremony and ritual of, you know.
Well, initially it was nothing. It didn't do anything. In hindsight, I think I could have gotten up and just walked off without knowing I had won the money. In the place that says insert coin, it was just flashing see attendant. There wasn't any buzzers or lights or whistles or anything like that. And the cocktail waitress was close by, and I had no idea what I was facing. Mm-hmm. And I said, does this belong to me? Is this money mine? And she said, I believe so, but let me go get somebody. And so just like in the movies, you know, within 15-20 seconds, there's a couple guys dressed up in nice suits, you know, Italian looking guys that, you know, just shaking my hand. And they said, Mr. Horrell, we can't promise you that you've won this money. We have to review this. These slot machines don't belong to us. There's a company that leases these from us. They have to review the tapes, make sure your cousin, uncle, sister, brother wasn't in here jacking around with the, you know, making it work for you. Mm-hmm. And I said, that'll work. And about that time, a guy with a big tool belt and a ponytail came up behind me, and he slapped me on the back and he said, congratulations, how does it feel to be a millionaire? And it was really more than I could handle. I thought, ooh, this may not be the best thing in the world. Even at that point in my life, I thought this might not be the best thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And so they called the people over. Somebody was paged from the IGT, the company that owns those machines, and they came over and validated the machine. I had the option to take a 20-year annuity or to take it all in a lump sum. Hmm. And I took the lump sum value because, you know, I was going to be so good with my money and I was going to invest it wisely.
Yeah,
I was
going
to do all these wonderful things. Yeah. I was going to do anything but be that idiot that you see on TV that wins the money.
And you were a small business owner, so you knew a little bit, you know, you knew something about money. I guess you heard all the stories of people that, you know, spend all their money after they win the lottery, or, you know, that you hear all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I've never been through that, so I can't judge. I can't say, well, I would be the prudent, you know, and I think a lot of people would probably, you know, it would be very different if you were thrown into that situation. So I'm interested in how, you know, where I guess, you know, I don't want to rehash too much, have you rehash too much of something that was perhaps a little painful, but I am interested in how that went after this sort of life-changing experience occurred.
Listen, I can hash and rehash all of it. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. Not only the winning of the money was great, the losing of the money has been where the real beauty lies. And it was, I really don't know how to explain it to somebody in the outside world who doesn't have a problem with drinking or drugs. To say that it all happened so fast just doesn't make any sense. To say that through an 8-year period it all happened so fast, it did. It just became, I've always been a drinker. I've always liked to have fun. And somehow the 5 o'clock drink turned into the noon drink, turned into the 10 a.m. drink. And, you know, eventually it was the 5 a.m. drink. And it was how I functioned. And the drinking got to be too much. So I would take pain pills to kind of brighten my mood. And then, you know, two pain pills turned into 4, turned into 8, turned into 12, turned into me, you know, falling asleep and nodding off. So my solution to that was to start taking speed to keep me up. And my problem there is I take too much speed, so then I need something to bring me down. So then I take, you know, Valium at night. And before I know it, I've got a $300 a day habit just to maintain.
And is that because you didn't have anything else to worry about? You know, all the money's taken care of, money problems taken care of.
And this is something that I think would be really hard for someone who hasn't been through this to put themselves in this position. And I can't speak for anyone else, but, you know, with the winning of the money came a feeling like my identity had somewhat been taken away. like I became, I suddenly went from being Wilson, the hardworking kind of blue collar guy who's going to start his own business and be successful on his own, to kind of feeling like I was that stooge that won $2 million and who can't make it when they win $2 million. Mm. So I felt somewhat like, you know, I've been screwed. Like, how am I ever going to prove myself as a worthy person or as a worthy businessman, you know, if I've been handed all this? And I hated it. I hated that part of it. Mm. And so the only way for me to overcome that was to work, get big, show people, hey, I can do this regardless, money or no money. I'm just going to expand and grow. And my ego became such that, you know, it was far more important for me to do $1 million in revenue a year,
right,
even if it meant making $30,000 a year, than it was to do $300,000 in revenue a year, right, and make $100,000.
Okay.
You know, I just wanted big.
Yeah.
You know, I have the disease of more. I just wanted more.
Right. So you're sinking some of this money back into your business to try and just grow it for the sake of growing the business. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And there wasn't any benchmark. I mean, when I'm watching, I had wisely invested it. You know, I had the right people to do that. I had the right people around me. I don't have anybody trying to screw me. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear about all that. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from a good family. People care about me. People, you know, provided me with good advice, and I had good people that said, do this. Mm-hmm. And I would watch it on the computer, and, you know, before the taxes were paid and before, you know, at the thick of it, you know, I would watch this money fluctuate $18,000-$25,000 a day, you know, in the market. And so how am I going to compete with that? You know, I don't know if I'm making money or losing money as far as my business goes, because how important is making $50,000 when you have, you know, a $20,000 fluctuation every day? And so I just got lost in it all. I didn't have any direction. I just knew to keep swimming, but I was in a pool where I didn't know where the ends were.
Right. Yeah. That's, it's a fascinating experience, or fascinating, you know, concept, because we hear all this, you know, and I think we all think this at some level. You know, if I only, you know, had one, I only have $1 million, or if I only, you know, if I could win the lottery, or if I could get this thing, or, you know, get this credential, or get this client, or whatever, then everything would be great. And, you know, you had that thing happen to you, and it, you know, life goes on, and, you know, like you say, it took away your identity. So you're really having to, I guess you had to struggle a lot, to recapture it.
It was, and it was an illusion, you know, and I kept telling myself, you know, $2 million, which turned into the $2.3 million. I took the lump sum, so it was 1.6, and the 1.6 after taxes was 1.1, and the 1.1 after I divvied it up in my family, I had about $600,000 cash to play with, which is a lot of money, but it's not enough to buy an island and just sit back and relax.
Yeah.
And somebody like me starts feeling like, well, I wish I had that money before they took away the taxes, or I wish it would have been $10 million, because then I could just really sit back and do nothing.
Right.
And then once I had it down to $600,000, I wish I had the million. And then once I was down to $300,000, I wish if I just had the $600,000. Right. So I'm just never content. There's never. It had nothing to do with the money, and everything to do with just my level of contentment. And no amount of money could satisfy that.
Right. And at what point did it, you know, did it slide into this, you know, this point of, the bottom, if you like? How did
it started to go down pretty quick? For so long, I was functioning at such what I would consider a high level, and, you know, take that for what it's worth, a high level to some extent. But I felt like I'm okay. You know, I've got this. Maybe I need to change a few things, but I'm all right. And it wasn't until the point that I told myself, I think you have a problem, that I really had a problem. Because at the point that I decided maybe I have a problem, every day was my last day. And so I was going to quit drinking. I was going to quit popping pills every day. And so each day being my last day was, let's eat, drink, and be merry today. And tomorrow we'll sober up and get right. But, you know, people like anybody who's anything like me knows that tomorrow never comes. It just goes on. And that's when it really kind of, I started pushing my limits, how much I could put in my body, you know, how much I could take. And eventually everything just kind of started to run together. The wheels started falling off. My wife at the time had left with my children, and I was alone in my house. My nephew had been born. I didn't attend his birth. My daughter's birthday had come and gone, and I had not even spoken to her. She's only 2 years old at the time, but she was old enough to connect, you know, or old enough to coo over the phone or show up. And, you know, I was just losing sight of everything that I identified myself to be as a person. And ultimately, my solution was, you know, in the form of a pistol, and I was going to blow my brains out. And that was what I wanted more than anything in this world, was the courage to do that. And I woke up one morning in a scurry because a guy that I work with was in my house because he was concerned about me. He had come in through the back door. So I woke up like nothing was the matter, as always. And I drove myself to treatment, said something's got to give.
And did that then start the turnaround, or was that a long process?
It was a long, hard, rocky process. Yeah. And that came with 6 days of detox where I checked out, and I said, you know, I'm never doing any of that stuff again. I'm never drinking. I'm never taking another pill. Maybe I'll smoke some weed. You know, maybe I'll, you know, I'm making all these negotiations with myself before I even get out of the mental institute. So I leave there, and I make it from the back door of treatment to the front door of my truck, where I have a half open 24-ounce beer that's been sitting out there in July temperature for 6 days, and some Lore tabs. And I, you know, take a handful of those, take a few pulls off the beer, and, you know, I'm right back to where I started. And 48 hours later, 72 hours later, I'm back in the loony bin, and something changed. And, you know, I decided I really wanted the help, and started to hang around 12-step meetings like all the time, 12-step meetings. And it was a long, long road of reconstruction and depression and fatigue and loneliness and isolation and everything that goes with the beauty of recovery.
Okay. Well, thanks for thanks for sharing that. But I think it's it puts a lot of stuff into context. And I think you know, one of the things that struck me was just when you're talking about, well, I wish I had the, you know, instead of the 600, you know, the 1 million, and, you know, if it was the 2 million, I want the 10 million. And, you know, it's always something more that I think drive us to, you know, to behaviors that are not healthy, whether or not, you know, that's similar to what you experienced, or just behaviors around stretching our credit cards too much, or buying a house that's a little bit too big, or, you know, whatever. And we're always looking for that sense of fulfillment in something else, and waiting for, you know, waiting for the next thing that's going to, you know, create this nirvana, this bliss, as opposed to being, you know, present, which, you know, I think we all at some level, you know, struggle with. And
it's a common struggle for most of us, because most of us aren't going to have the opportunity to have that kind of money. You know, it's just like going to an amusement park and riding a roller coaster for the first time. Yeah, it's fun and there's a lot of adrenaline involved. But if they said, here's the key, man, you can ride this roller coaster every day. How many days you really think you're going to hang around and just ride that roller coaster? Yeah. It's just like anything else. It gets old.
Yeah. And I think the what you're winning all that money did is just put a magnifying glass on all of this stuff. So, you know, you exist, all of these things inside you, probably, you know, they existed. And, you know, the fact that you won all this money, just magnified it by, you know, 100 times or 2 million times or whatever it is. And I guess that's perhaps what created, you know, that sort of acceleration. I don't know. I'm speculating here, but
you nailed it on the head. That's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Basically what that did is it fast forwarded what I was going to eventually become. Mm-hmm. And that's where my gratitude comes for the whole process, because in hindsight, I probably could have lived my entire life as an alcoholic. I probably could be a 70-year-old Scotch drinking, whiskey drinking, miserable ass of a guy that was just angry and felt screwed all the time.
Right.
Because that's the road I was going down. Fortunately, I was able to speed that up times a million, literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. and realize that there is an alternative to that sort of life.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Okay, cool. There's so much really good stuff in there, and thanks for that. And I want to transition here into the world of endurance sport, because somehow along the way you discovered endurance sport, or you got into it, or it was something that helped you with your recovery, and I wanted to touch on that. When did that happen?
Yeah. Absolutely. I was spending most of my time, as I said, either in the bed or at 12-step meetings. I was terribly depressed. I was living with my dad. I played high school athletics. I was a football player in high school. I knew that there was something there, but I had lost connection with anything physical or any sort of exercise. I was smoking about 3 packs of cigarettes a day. I had switched from vodka and speed and opiates to chocolate cake and Marlboro Lights was kind of my thing. And my father and I had gotten into a disagreement, and I was walking around the block one day in like probably August, it's 100-degree temperature and blue jeans and some oversized shirt, about 300 pounds, and, smoking my cigarette, walking down the street. And a feeling just came over me and said, I wonder if I could jog from this light post to that light post. And so I just kind of waddled out this, probably 17, 18 minute mile pace for maybe 30 yards. Mm-hmm. And I got there and I thought, this feels okay. I'm going to walk to the next light post. I'm going to try that again. And if I can do that again, I'm going to smoke a cigarette. I'm going to enjoy that cigarette. Yeah. And I did that, and I got home that night, and I laid in bed and I thought, I want to get to a treadmill and see what a mile looks like, mm-hmm. see what that feels like. If I can still, can I jog a mile? Can I walk a mile? Can I make it through a mile? Because, this has been 20 years or 15 years since I've done virtually anything. And I got to the treadmill. I joined a gym, was doing a little bit of, I was spinning my wheels, but I was doing something. I was active. And then I found Olive Branch CrossFit. I found the CrossFit community, and that's where my life really, really started to change. Okay. I found a group of people that I found community there, and through CrossFit, there was an endurance runner who was the owner of the gym, and there's just not a lot of weightlifting, distance running. That combination is somewhat rare.
Yeah, I wanted to talk. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. I've had there's a sort of an endurance sport thread that runs through my podcast, and partly it's because my podcast is about things I enjoy, and so I enjoy endurance sport, and I always find it interesting to hear stories about people who get into the endurance world, also the ultra endurance world, because there's a high correlation between people who do some of the stuff that you've done and who've also are recovering, alcoholics or addicts or whatever. And I don't know what that, I don't know what that is. It's probably, people will say it's trading one addiction for the other, perhaps. Maybe it's something more. And I haven't had that, but I really love endurance sport, and I'm fascinated by the really ultra side of it. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. And were you trading one thing for the other, or was it was there something else going on?
You know, I certainly wouldn't argue against that. Mm-hmm. You hear that a lot, and you sometimes hear that with a negative connotation. And
yeah.
The way that I look at it is, the way that I'm wired, I'm just like that. I'm going to be hooked on something. I've never done anything once that I wasn't going to do forever.
Sure.
You know, if I'm going to go camping with my son with the Boy Scouts, then the next thought in my mind is I'm going to climb Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I go fly fishing, if I go fishing with a bobber one day, then I'm thinking about, you know, the river runs through it and fly fishing for the rest of my life. I have that about me, and I've kind of learned to just embrace that and and, you know, what difference does it make? If it is one addiction for the other, I'm happy I have this addiction versus the other.
That's right. Yeah, I think you hit on something that's really, really important. And I heard you talk about it in another one of your podcasts. And that was that, we do, as human beings, we do have a need to explore something that's bigger than ourselves. We have a need to be outside. We have a need to move our bodies. We have a need to do all kinds of things that are that they're antithetical to the way that our society's set us up, that, you know, you have to get the job and you have to do this and everything in moderation. And I also think there's an element of this in decision making as well, that we make decisions based on mind and body as well, and all these things interact, and we lose touch with that if we sort of follow the rules all the time, if you like. And I think you're onto something there. It's, you know, maybe it is, you're right, maybe it is trading one addiction for the other, but, you know, there are good addictions, aren't there?
Sure. And at the end of the day, what difference does it make?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love black and white. Who doesn't? I want to know why this works this way, and I want to know the reasons for this and that. And I can spend all day long trying to figure out that kind of stuff, but the bottom line is I'm not really that smart of a guy, and it doesn't make a lot of difference, you know, whether it is one addiction for the other, or why I do this, why I drank, or why I drugged, or, you know, what's going on internally. Sure, some of that stuff is important to some degree, but at the end of the day, I do things in a very addict-like way, and the sooner that I start accepting that as opposed to trying to change that, then life became easier. And I started to see that, you know, there are some good tendencies here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't all bad. You know, being a drug addict and an alcoholic is not the worst thing in the world. And I've heard people tell stories that, you know, from the primal days, those were the people who functioned at the highest level, the ones who needed the instant gratification, who, when they got hungry, they went and ate. You know, that whatever they needed right now, they got it right then. Of course, now we live in a society where, unfortunately, I can get a bag of Cheetos, a bottle of liquor, and a bottle of pills right now. And that's more where I tend to the direction I tend to go in. But at the end of the day, it's just, you know, a tiger can't change its stripes, but it can, you know, learn to appreciate them.
What are some of the, maybe the lessons that you took away? And it sounds like you're not the type of guy who gives unsolicited advice to people, but you know, and I don't want you to do that, either, but maybe if you could go back and just, rewind the clock a little bit to either 20-year-old self or, I don't know, pick an age, and you would, you'd give that person the Wilson of 1998, 1999, you pick a year. What would that advice be, knowing what you know now?
First of all, thank you. That's the ultimate compliment to me, for you to say that I don't sound like the kind of person who'd give unsolicited advice. My biggest fear is coming across as if I want to portray myself as an expert in anything, because I'm the furthest thing from that.
Well,
but if I could go back and talk to myself at a younger age, I would tell myself to relax, take it easy, and understand that this is all supposed to be fun. You know, this life is supposed to be fun, and don't get so caught up into what society wants you to believe that you're supposed to be, because most of the time society hasn't, the way that I've felt that society was pushing me has been something that I've misconstrued on the front end. Mm-hmm. And I get so wrapped up in doing things right that, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do things right. Mm-hmm. And just having fun is something that I've never, even if it's something that I enjoy, I can suck the fun right out of it. And you know that with endurance sports or anything that you're doing, you know, I can do this podcast, which I love to enjoy, which I enjoy so much. And I love meeting new people, and I can get off the other end of this computer and walk back to my house and say, man, I didn't do a good job. I should have done this. I should have spoke about that. He probably thinks I'm an idiot for this. Or I can get off the endurance race and get off the trail and say, man, I'm finished in almost last place, and I'm so slow. I got to get better. And it's like, man, where's the gratitude that, man, I got the use of my legs. I got everything's working properly. I'm a healthy guy. I'm getting to meet people. You know, I don't have to impress everybody all the time or any of the time. I don't have to impress anybody. I just need to learn to have some fun.
Yeah, no, that's a great, I think we've all been there. You know, there's that wonderful phrase, congratulations, you're a human being, you know. Perfectionism is one of the ways that that I think, you know, people make a lot of either they don't make decisions, or as you say, they take the fun out of the things that they're doing. This is a show about risk, and we actually haven't gotten into risk, but we will. But I think there's a lot of risk in not embracing the fun of what it is that we're trying to do, because it's I feel this, you know, same way. I'm a cyclist, so it's always like, there's a noise coming out of my bike, or there's I have to get this bit of equipment. I mean, equipment is a black hole of, like, it sucks your money. You can buy the next jacket, the next, you know, whatever. This is how we're designed, or how there's a lot of design around our the way in which we live. And I think you hit the nail on the head about, like, just be grateful that you got to go outside and run, and you get to do this and you get to do that. It is really difficult. We hear a lot about gratitude. It becomes a bit of a, you know, something that we hear over and over again, but I think there's something really profound there.
Yeah, I don't think that there's anything in my life more powerful than gratitude. Mm-hmm. There's nobody in the world that's more capable than me of being a completely miserable person with the world at his fingertips.
We're all there. I hear you, because I'm very much, I can absolutely do the same thing, Wilson. So don't you're not alone in that regard. Do you do this is the thing, right? So I was about to ask you, do you have like a gratitude practice, right? And this is, you know, you hear a lot about that's important, but at the same time, it's like, well, now I have to do my gratitude practice, and becomes another thing that we have to do. But I'm curious how you address that.
Well, with sobriety, I found another addiction of mine is spirituality, and that's, you know, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but just appreciating who I am and where I am, and, you know, all the things that I have. And, you know, I have what someone, a friend of mine, referred to as Cadillac problems. You know, the problems that I have in my life are problems that most people would do anything to have.
Right.
You know, when I have I had a hot water heater go out on Thanksgiving, and, you know, I was laughing with my wife. I told her, I said, you know, if we didn't have this damn house with running water and showers and electricity, we wouldn't have to worry about hot water heat.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of problems that I have because I have other things.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't have the kind of problems that some people have. And having children that are healthy, mm-hmm. and having a wife that's caring and having a roof to stay under and a bed to sleep in, you can't ask for a whole lot more mm-hmm. than that. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't promised that when I got here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm conscious of that as often as possible. And right. I have to be, because otherwise, like I said, I'm completely unconscious of it, and everybody's screwing me over, and the world sucks.
I can go.
There's so quickly, I have to constantly be pounding in what is good about this.
Yeah,
you know, having the flat tire is not the problem. Having three tires that are good and a vehicle that runs is the bonus.
And the ability to change it, and you know, all the rest of it. Yeah. Do you practice any sort of meditation or anything like that?
I tell people I'm the only person that I know that can sit down to meditate and give myself an anxiety attack trying to clear my thoughts. So I've tried to sit down. I've tried to cross my legs. My hips aren't very flexible, so I can't hardly get in that position. Once I get on the ground, it's a pain in the ass to get back up. So I'm more of a behind the wheel yogi, I would say.
I
do a lot of my meditation comes in the form of, you know, going through my daily activities.
Cool. Very refreshing. So thanks for that. Really interesting perspective. I mean, one of the things, like, I would you're very, you know, sort of self-aware, though. You know what
works and what doesn't for you, which is a lot of people don't.
Well, that's the good news and the bad news. with self-awareness comes the awareness that you got that.
Yeah, but it becomes easier to deal with it. So really useful. I want to get into lift heavy, run long, and what's that all about. And for my listeners, what is it, and when did you start it? And
that's the biggest blessing in my life, most certainly, you know, aside from all the things that have come from it. Lift heavy, run long is something that was started by the CrossFit gym owner that I told you about, Vaughn mm-hmm. Rawls, and mm-hmm. it was just something that he did for fun. And he started this 50-mile, 400-pound deadlift club.
Okay.
And this came when he was at his first 50-mile endurance race. And as he was surveying the other participants, he noticed that he was a little bit out of place because he's a meatier guy, big, right. stronger guy. And he began to wonder how many of these guys could deadlift 400 pounds.
Right. Yeah.
Not that any of these guys cared to deadlift 400 pounds, but just, you know, started a little club. Mm. You know, and I hate the term club because I'm an all-inclusive kind mm-hmm. of guy. And so this makes it sound like it's something that you have to be initiated into. But anyways, that was a goal. And through Lift Heavy, Run Long, getting into that club was very important to me. And so that was what started my journey. After deadlifting the 400 pounds and finishing the 50-mile race, I came to Vaughn one day and I said, you know, I really want to be part of this. Like, I want to grow this. I want to do something with it. You know, how can I get my foot in the door? How can I partner up with you? Because I think that there's a lot of people in the running world and a lot of people in the lifting world that are such great people, because I kind of came across the lines. Mm. You know, there seems to be like a not an animosity between the two, but you know, the runners think that you got to run and the lifters think that you got to lift, and the two just can't get along. And I don't want to make it out like they're throwing spears at each other, but you know, we all are pretty strong minded people and we have our beliefs of what's right and what's wrong. And I was just welcomed into both communities with open arms, and it was so instrumental. Both communities were so instrumental in saving my life, literally, that, you know, I just felt like I want all my friends to play in the same sandbox. And what can we do to get these people together, and not necessarily to say that you can do both or one should do the other or this way's right or that way's right, and not necessarily to benefit the elite athlete or the 100-mile runner or the 600-pound deadlifter. But what about the poor son of a bitch like me who's stuck on the couch in a depression that really wants to do the mile on the treadmill but doesn't know where to start, doesn't have anybody to share it with, doesn't have anybody to encourage him to do it? You know, what about that guy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so why don't we see if we can get kind of everybody to come together and of the same mindset that let's just encourage and be active, whether active means running 50-mile races, doing Ironmans, or whether it means walking around the block so you have the motivation to push your kids on the swing and, you know, get out to the playground.
Mm-hmm. So this is like a community and a movement that you founded, and is that where you're based? People come together and do stuff?
It's really taken off all around.
Right.
We have this Facebook community.
Okay.
It's Lift Heavy Run Long Athletes, and it's a private group that anyone can join.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look for it on Facebook, it's people from all over the country. It's people from all over the world that have found, you know, a lot of people come to us and say, I've been looking for like-minded people, the hybrid athlete, the people who run and lift. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of people are just, you know, folks that like to run, bike, swim, whatever it is they like to do, and are looking to, you know, get some information, get some encouragement, or just have some fun. So it's been pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, I love that concept, because we get into these tribes, right? You become a runner, so I'm a runner now, and you know, you associate with runners, and it feels good, you know. I'm a runner, and you know, even though this guy qualified for the Boston Marathon, but I'm still in that same tribe as this guy. So I think that's where some of the animosity comes from, because it's like, oh, those guys over there think that, you know, you have to lift 400 pounds to, you know, that's what makes you an athlete.
That's exactly right. And I suffer from that as well. You know, I know what this person, oh, that guy's a CrossFitter, so he's this, and that person's a runner, so she's that, and that person's a cycler. And I suffer from that probably more than anybody that I know. But I also realize that I suffer from the human condition, and that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, every one of us, regardless of whatever we associate ourselves with, we all want to be loved and we all want to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to create a place where where we have that. Mm-hmm. And there, I've always had this real, I'm so adverse to someone telling me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, and I get defensive of that, even if somebody's not if somebody says you need to do this, I'm immediately like,
you won't do
not
it.
Doing it.
Yeah.
And so with Lift Heavy Run Long, I felt like none of this makes, all of this goes against the grain of normal thinking,
right?
Of traditional, you know, thought. So therefore, let's do that.
Right.
If it doesn't make sense and people say we shouldn't be doing it, let's do it.
Right.
So, you know, I started this blog, I started writing. I've never identified myself as a writer, but I started doing some race reports, some self-deprecating perspective sort of things that just became a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And Lift Heavy Long became that blog. And it's a blog that's basically about perspective that has very little to do with lifting or running.
Mm.
It's something that doesn't make any sense. Therefore, I felt the need to continue doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, you know, I've just gotten to meet a lot of really neat people like yourself. You know, I wouldn't get to have the opportunity to meet you and meet people like you if it wasn't for Lift Heavy Run Long in this community.
Yeah, I think the power of podcasting and online communities is it's just tremendous. I mean, I get to meet somebody like you, and you can create communities of people from all over the world in these far-flung countries. It's one of the very powerful things about the internet. I wanted to ask if sort of somebody's, you know, power lifter, right? And they're really that's what they do or they identify. And I know, so we're going back a little bit on this unsolicited advice thing, but if what could that person get out of running a 5K, for example, or a 10K? How might they, you know, benefit from that?
you know, I can't tell them what they would get.
Yeah.
I can tell them that they're missing something by not going and getting that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the beauty of it lies, is you can't, you can't explain, you know, what something is going to give you, but there's something there. It's transformative.
Yes. Any,
all sorts of exercises are transformative. The same way that, you know, if playing chess or singing in a choir or learning a new instrument, you can't tell somebody exactly what they're going to get out of it, but they're going to get something different from running a 5K than you get from squatting 500 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and if there's that opportunity to see what else is out there, I want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I want to do as many things as possible before, you know, I reached, we talked about it earlier, I reached a point where I wanted, more than anything in the world, I wanted to die. And fortunately, I didn't get that. However, I'm pretty sure that day's coming at some point. It happens to most of us, from what I hear.
Yeah, yeah.
So between now and then, I want to squeeze in as many feelings of 5Ks, 50-milers, bike rides, rows, you know, pushing my kids around swings, whatever it is that I can do to experience.
Sure.
I want to experience.
Sure.
I want to encourage other people to experience and help the people that are a little bit afraid.
Yeah.
Afraid to experience those new things. I want to be there to say, come on, and I want to make this as comfortable as possible.
Sure, sure. And I guess the same for the marathoner who's never picked up a dumbbell in his or her life is the same. You know, you don't know it until you try. I love the ethos of it. It's so powerful. And what about competition? What are your views on competition?
I don't know that I have any view. It's easier to have a viewpoint of softer competition when you're not very much of a competitor.
Hmm.
You know, from my point of view, from where I stand, I'm a very competitive person per se. I don't like to lose, and I can throw a huge temper tantrum whenever I lose at something that I feel like that I'm capable of winning. But from where I stand in the endurance side of things, I am so far at the back of the pack that it's not something that I really concern myself with a great deal. And I can also be so competitive that I'll never find happiness in what I'm doing.
Mm.
So if I want to, I can spend 30 miles telling myself about how overweight and slow and lazy and dumb and how I've always been this way, and I can do that.
Hmm.
You know, or I can get out there and just be a participant, and that's where I am in the field of, mm-hmm. of running and, you know, weightlifting.
Yeah. Yeah, I struggle with that myself. It's always you always sort of go back and compare your results to people in your class or your age group or whatever. And I like to do that, but I also, you know, I like to compete against myself. But yeah, it can be a slippery slope, because there's, you know, it comes back to what we were talking about earlier. There's always going to be someone a little faster than you, a little stronger. And you know, you can get angry about that, or you can enjoy the progress that you're making. So,
and also keep in mind, I sit over here as a back of the pack guy and I say, well, competition's not that important. I don't really focus on it. Ask me again when I'm finished third and fourth place in some races, how important it becomes. So I can't safely say that I feel that way about competition.
Right, right. Okay. One of the themes of my show is around uncertainty. And I think we actually, in our conversation, I think this is a theme that's been running through a lot of stuff. Because one of the things that drive our behavior, I think, is the need to eliminate uncertainty, whether that's winning loads of money or whatever. And my philosophy is actually we have to just embrace and play with uncertainty, because you know that it's all around us. And life would be pretty dull if it didn't. But I don't know. I'm curious about your thoughts on that. If you have any thoughts on, some people want a lot more security and stability, and other people just like, you know, throw caution to the wind. Where would you sit on that spectrum?
I love it. I love the unknown. I love not knowing what the day is going to bring, and I love being overly optimistic to the point of unrealistic. I had a friend of mine tell me to remain irrationally optimistic and in a overwhelming state of gratitude. And when I wake up in the mornings, I'm so excited about what's coming that day that it's too much to ask, you know, because I don't know what's coming, but I know what it's like to wake up one day and just kind of be smoking cigarettes and drinking a few beers and pull a machine for $2 million. You know, who's to say that things like that can't happen every day? And when I wake up in the morning, I like the feeling of, you know, I don't have any idea what, there's never been a time in my life where I'm more unsure about the direction that I'm going. The podcast that we're doing, we don't have any sort of, you know, long game. We don't have any sort of structure or plan. Lift Heavy Run Long has absolutely zero structure, plan, you know, intention to really monetize or make it much of anything. And we don't, I think that's part of the beauty of it. You know, we have good intentions, and my intentions every day is to meet as many people as I can and try to be a beacon of hope as opposed to just another miserable guy complaining about what's not right in a perfect world. So yeah, I embrace it.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. So the podcast is I've listened to a few of the episodes. You bring some guests on, and how do you pull it together? Where just as a fellow podcaster, what's the, you know, we can geek out a little bit on podcasts, but is it sort of weekly thing? And I know you have a little studio, and you know, it sounds like fun.
It is fun. We're the furthest thing from together as you could possibly imagine. So if you can take any comfort in that, then here's the place to get it. Because we, if there is anybody who doesn't have their stuff together, it would be me and my wife and Vaughn Rawls, who I do the podcast with, and we love it.
We
just have a lot of fun. We're in search of people who are willing to sit down with us and tell us stories. And our belief is that they're all fascinating people. You know, it doesn't have to be a Guinness Book of World Record holder. It doesn't have to be a top level athlete. Sure. I think that all of us are inspiring. I think all of us have a story to tell, and I think all of us lead incredible lives. And sadly, I think that most of us don't believe that because we've been engulfed in that life. But you know, what you have going in your world is going to be completely different than what I have going in mine. And the way that you live your life is going to be fascinating to somebody who doesn't live their life the way that you live yours. And I want to hear as many stories and make as many connections as I possibly can. And I also want to do that while not taking myself too seriously.
It's a great ethos, and you know, your show is really well put together. Really, I like the chemistry, and the people you have on have got some great stories, and it's just fascinating because you also tape it on video, right? You've got a YouTube channel. I haven't done that yet, so I'm thinking about whether or not it's worthwhile, but it's it gives another dimension to it, right?
Well, it's just kind of fallen into that. And this studio that we built, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, my sort of obsessive compulsive nature was like, we were doing it in the house and it was a pain to bring the equipment in and out. And I have a shop out back. So the next thing you know, we got a studio that replicates the log house that we live in. And we don't have a big YouTube audience at all. Our views are very small, but you know what views we can get is potential to make new connections, and we just enjoy, have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I think what's important is you seems like you have a sense of community around it, which for me is, you know, same thing. I'm not after, you know, sort of millions and millions of listeners, and it's not really why I do it, to, you know, to beef up the numbers or anything. But if you can create a sense of community, people that are sort of like-minded and can share and you know, follow the guests, then that can be very strong. That's what I'm finding. I don't have a huge listenership, but it seems to be very very cohesive and you know, very very powerful.
Well, and I found that we touch the guest as much as we touch anyone else, and that's what I'm looking for. Even if we can make someone realize sort of how special and unique they are, there's a lot of power in that.
Mm-hmm. What would you what would you say to people listening to your podcast, to mine, just around, you know, you talked about sometimes we talk ourselves down a little bit. How would you, again, unsolicited advice, say, but how would you try to bring that out of someone or help them realize some of the hidden strengths and that they might have that are latent?
I would say it's important to be aware that the person that you are going to be does not have to have any. The person that you are going to be is not based on the person who you have been. And I suffer from that problem, kind of going back to high school days and younger days and being like, well, I'm not a podcast guy. Like, I'm not supposed to be doing this. People don't expect this of me. Right. And I'm more of the mindset now that, you know, if it scares me, you know, if it's not hurting anyone, if it interests me, I need to go do that and see what that's all about. You know, and I think that there's the uncertainty, like we talked about, is really important. That's where the fun is. You know, you don't have to live your life based on the belief that you're supposed to be this or you're supposed to be that. You know, I go through my day, and if I say it would be cool if, I want to follow through with that. You know, how often do you say it would be really cool if, and then you just let that go? It'd be really awesome if. Well, if it'd be really awesome, go do it. You know, don't give me the excuses that I don't have the money or I don't have this or what's the next step. That'll all take care of itself. There's a lot of things that you can do without money. There's a lot of steps that you can take that don't involve being at that place yet. Yeah, and there's just a lot of cool stuff out there that you could be doing with your life that you know, is just too fearful to do. And I get that.
And you know, quite clearly, there's a lot of things you could do with money that, you know, maybe, as you know, that might not be a great thing. So, you know, once again, don't wait for that $1 million to come around the corner, because it may not be what you're looking for.
And if it does come around, don't call me to invest it.
This has been really, you know, really great. I really appreciate you coming on. I think we covered a lot of ground, but was there anything that you wanted to cover that we didn't get a chance to?
No, I think that's about it. You know, I feel like that, you know, we stuck pretty much to just, you know, I want people to try things. I want people to, I have a strong belief that community, making connection, is what it's all about.
Yeah.
And there's just not enough time in the day. We're so busy. There's so many things going on, so many commitments, and we have to wear so many masks that sometimes we forget that the whole point of this is just to enjoy ourselves and be comfortable with ourselves. And, you know, if everything is going to be okay in the end, then why not enjoy all the interim? Yeah. You know, don't wait until you're 60 years old to retire and have fun. You know, don't wait. Just go get it and be comfortable with yourself. I think it's very, very important to find comfort in yourself. And once you change the way that you view yourself, then the world that you live in does change.
What about fear? People tend to not make decisions when they're afraid of the downside. They're afraid of negative consequences. How do you approach your own fear?
I'm probably the most fearful person that I've ever met. And I have a lot of different ways of expressing my fear. But throughout most of my life, it's been using my size, you know, to intimidate. And the way that I express my fear is through anger, you know, and I have a lot of different ways of showing that I'm fearful other than saying, hey, man, I'm really scared.
Right.
And I found that there's a great deal of happiness inside vulnerability and allowing myself to be vulnerable and getting with other people and saying, hey, man, I really want to do this podcast, but it scares me. I'm really scared that people are going to laugh at me. I'm really scared that I'm going to be exposed as some kind of idiot. I really think that, you know, I'm really afraid that people are going to say that I'm this or that. And then taking all that and doing it anyway. That's the beauty of it. That's where the fun, that's where my drugs are today is in the facing of the fear. You know, because like they say, if you're not afraid to do it, it's not courage. You know, you got to have fear to have courage.
Yeah, I think that's a really good, bit of, again, bit of advice. you know, and again, I always, I find it a little bit, I struggle a little bit with the whole self-help genre. I do find that I, sometimes, you know, with my guests, with the podcast, with some of the shorter episodes that I do, I find myself saying things that sound, you know, a little bit sort of like the self-help world, but I'm just doing it for, I'm sharing my own experiences and views, and I tell people that they can take or leave whatever, you know, whatever works for them.
When you say that, do you mean that you have an insecurity of sounding like?
Yeah, I don't want to sound like a self-help guru. To be honest. Yeah. I'd rather, you know, I don't want to sound phony or inauthentic or, anything like that. I want to make it, this is about, as much as anything, a show about authenticity. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make it sound I'm, you know, there is an industry around it, and I'm not in it, and I don't want to be in it. So
yeah. Well, it can be uncomfortable to care.
Yeah,
you know, it can be uncomfortable to try to do the right thing and worry about what other people think. But you seem like you do a really fine job of it to me.
Oh, thanks, Wilson. I think we covered a lot. Before we finish off, where can people find you?
You can find me at www.liftheavyrunlong.com, and I put up my weekly blog on there, and we have our podcast on there. Our YouTube channel is under Lift Heavy Run Long, and you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Lift Run Long.
Brilliant. Okay.
And also on Facebook, you can search for the Lift Heavy Run Long Athletes group.
Brilliant.
And if you find that, ask to join and jump right in. Don't feel like you have to be this, that, or the other. Just come on, have some fun, be a part of it.
Brilliant. Wilson, this is great. Thanks very much. And let's stay very much in touch. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely, Ben. Thank you so much.
Absolute
pleasure. This has been great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure. Stay in touch with me.
Bye for now. Well, lots of good stuff to take away from that, I think. And as a result of my conversation with Wilson, I thought of two exercises that I think I might try, and maybe you could try as well. The first is if you catch yourself, or if I catch myself hoping for an extremely unlikely high impact event that I have very little influence over, like winning the lottery, I'm going to try to stop myself and focus on something else. The second exercise that I will try, and you might want to try, is to maybe have a look at some of the things about yourself that you'd like to change, or think about how some of perhaps your less desirable qualities might be exacerbated as a result of, say, winning the lottery. Have a look at that as well, and think about how you might want to change those things.
Check out liftheavyrunlong.com. That's Wilson's website. That's the community that he is a co-host, co-founder of. You can check out, they have a podcast, they have a number of great resources. And check out the show notes as usual. And it's been a few weeks since I've ask this, but if you do enjoy the show, why don't you leave a rating or a review of All Things Risk, particularly on iTunes? It helps us out a lot. And of course, if you haven't subscribed to All Things Risk, check out allthingsrisk.co.uk. You can find out, you can find all the ways in which you can get the show in various formats or apps, however you like to consume your podcasts. Feedback. I always value feedback. I would be very interested in any suggestions you might have for guests, things that you like or don't like about the show, anything else. For instance, would you like to see an All Things Risk YouTube channel? I would love to hear from you. Allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. We will be back next week with another episode. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.